Paul Howard's going to lead that discussion.
Okay, behind tab one, if you'd all get a very thick document. As you recall, in September, you were given a draft document of our operations handbook, practices, and policies, and we asked to provide comments to the staff by this council meeting so we could approve the final handbook. We received several minor comments that we made the corrections in the final document, and we culled out several important changes that we figure the council should review before they're incorporated. So I'm going to go through those. The executive committee looked at these recommended changes of substance and made some decisions on them. So what I'll do, if it's all right, Mr. Chairman, is go through what the executive committee believed as a straw man, and if there's any objections to that, then you might, if there are a lot of objections, we might discuss it further. If there are only a few, you might say, well, the majority agrees with what the executive committee did, or however you want to do it. But I'll start with the executive committee in section 3 on page 3. If you go to section 3, page 3, it was recommended that a bullet be added that says, and the assignment of council members to committees and designation of committee chairmanships. So in other words, as part of the duties of the executive committee, they would assign council members to committees and would assign the chairmanships of committees. Right now that's done by your chair. The executive committee did not agree with that change. They felt that the chair should be making the designations of who's on a committee, like it has been done for 25 years, and who also should chair those committees. But it would continue that the executive committee would offer advice on committee makeup and committee chairmanship based on knowledge and experience and things like that. So the executive committee disagrees with adding that change. Anyone disagree with that? Okay. The next one is on page 7. The next one is under page 5. Under plan development teams. Add to the end of terms of reference, all management alternatives shall incorporate and follow advice provided by the SSC. So if you go to page 5, if you look in page 5, there's a bullet halfway down on the left that says incorporate SSC recommendations as accepted by the council into management alternatives. That is similar to saying all management alternatives shall incorporate and follow advice provided by the SSC. And that bullet would be added under terms of reference on the other side, but it's similar to that. And the executive committee agreed to add that bullet, which would stress that the council is going to follow recommendations by its SSC as directed in the new Magnuson Act. So the council agreed with that one. The executive committee agreed with that.
Dave.
Well, two questions. I've been to a few SSC meetings. They're interesting affairs. Is the SSC a voting body or a consensus body?
It will be consensus body.
Okay. Personally, I think it should be a voting body, and I think we should get the results of the vote. I have seen them the attempts to achieve consensus at SSC meetings that have come down to being just short of people hitting each other over the head with chairs. They really go at it sometimes. And that's one issue. But the larger issue then is what happens if you don't have consensus and you have a minority report. I mean, we have in this document now, if a council member really feels strongly, he can submit a minority report to the Secretary of Commerce. I've seen the SSC disagree about something so violently and vehemently that, you know, there are people that would submit a minority report. And then my question is, what does the PDT do under that circumstance where they don't have a consensus on their scientific advice? I think this is going to happen quite frequently.
Let me read to you exactly what the councils are supposed to do and what the SSC is supposed to do. Our SSC shall provide the council ongoing scientific advice for fishery management decisions, including recommendations for acceptable biological catch, preventing overfishing, maximum sustainable yield, and achieving rebuilding targets, and reports on stock status and health, bycatch, habitat status, social economic impacts of management measures, and sustainability of fishing practices. So basically, our SSC is to provide us scientific advice on just about everything. And then the council is supposed to develop annual catch limits for each of its managed fisheries that may not exceed the fishing level recommendations of its SSC or peer review process established under that section. And what we're basically doing under our plan development teams, we're not discussing councils or SSCs, we're saying that under the plan development teams that we're going to follow what the Act is saying. We're going to follow the advice. The PDTs will follow that advice as they presented information to the council vetted through the SSC first.
I'll let somebody else speak, but I don't think you're understanding my question, so maybe somebody else will be able to clarify it better.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I disagree with the Executive Committee's position. First of all, I don't believe that the bullet on page 5 to incorporate SSC recommendations as accepted by the Council into management alternatives is the same as what the Executive Committee has agreed to. That is to say that all management alternatives shall incorporate and follow the advice provided by the SSC. Those are two different things entirely. As accepted by the Council into management alternatives, that's different. The Council is accepting those particular recommendations from the SSC. The Council's in the driver's seat in that particular case, the existing bullet in the document on page 5. I understand the Magnuson Act to the extent that anybody can understand the Magnuson Act, reauthorization, that is. However, I don't believe that we need to, certainly at this point in time, agree that we have to incorporate and follow the advice provided by the SSC, that all management alternatives should incorporate and follow the advice, especially because In the document prepared by the National Marine Fisheries Service, Office of Sustainable Fisheries, the one we got back in March, you know, I made it very clear that, well, nothing's really clear, but each council is required to develop annual catch limits for each of its managed fisheries that may not exceed the fishing level recommendations of its scientific and statistical committee or the peer review process. All right, so that's an option. Here, there's no option. The SSC says, this is it, and you buy it. Peer review process is out. So there's an inconsistency here that bothers me. This is giving the SSC too much power, and frankly, I'm also influenced by my experiences with the SSC. Not that I've had a lot of them. Got great respect for the people on the SSC, but I can recall one meeting. I was there, and one SSC member said, the council's not doing its job. We've got to force them to do that job. We're going to paint them in a corner. And that wasn't a scientific and statistical review. That wasn't a scientific review. That was just a personal opinion being foisted upon the council. So the SSC, the composition of the SSC, how we're going to interact with the SSC, I think that still needs to be worked out. And I'm not yet confident that this council has moved it far enough along for us to really understand what the SSC is going to be about. So, again, we're not obliged to do what the Executive Committee suggests we do. The Magnuson Act reauthorization does not oblige us to go as far as what the Executive Committee says, and that is all management alternatives shall incorporate and follow the advice provided by the SSC. That's too far.
Jim Salisbury.
Well, I would concur with Dr. Pierce, and I think it's a big difference between saying that you shall incorporate and follow the advice provided by the SSC and the statement that you shall not exceed the advice of the SSC. I mean, not exceeding is one thing, but this appears to me to say you can't do less than either. And I don't think we should tie the hands of the council that way. And I don't think it's legal for us to tie the hands of the council in that regard. Thank you.
Anyone else? Sally?
Yeah, I think it's not accurate to be referring to previous SSC meetings as what we would expect a newly formulated SSC to provide to this council. The guidance that we've been given from the Magnuson Act says you need to constitute an SSC that you're going to ask very important questions. And I would say that this council hasn't asked very important questions on a regular basis of its SSC. And I think as a result, we haven't gotten the kind of people to serve on that SSC that might raise the level of confidence that we have in the results of such a body. So, you know, I think the other thing we need to think about is this council is one of the reasons why those changes were made in the Magnuson Act. And, you know, whether you believe that or not, we need to be listening to what the Magnuson Act says now as far as listening to scientific advice and not ignoring it. If we elevate the level of advice that we're expecting to get from the SSC, we're going to get better membership on the SSC. It's going to be a place where people of very high quality are going to want to serve and are going to give us the kind of information that this body needs to be able to make better decisions that more people have more confidence in. So I obviously strongly support these changes so that we can actually have a scientific body that meets on a regular basis, that we know who these people are. I mean, I remember a meeting a couple of years ago. I didn't even know who. There was a gentleman in the audience. I looked out. I thought, he looks really familiar. And this was after I'd been on the council for 2 years already. It was the chair of the SSC. I didn't even know who he was. I mean, as embarrassing as that is, I think that's telling of how we have used our SSC, that after 2 years, I'd never even seen this person at a meeting before. We need to be incorporating scientists into our decision-making process, and this is a way to do it and to be more deliberate about it than we have been.
Jim Otto.
Yes, I'm opposed to this recommendation from the executive committee for both the same reasons Dr. Pierce and Jim Salisbury said it. I feel that go down this road, at some point we're not going to need a council. I think there's a lot of decisions that in management that may not be science-based. There can be two ways to get somewhere. As long as we have a goal and we one or the other way, two ways can both ways could get to the same place. We may decide we want to go a certain way, you know. So, and I think that's what our job is, not to have the SSC tell us how to manage the resource. So I'm opposed to this. I think it's going too far. I can't read this into Magnuson either. So.
Anyone else? Dave.
I'll take one more try now that I think my views have been clearly stated by other people, but I'll try again. I have no problem with taking advice that's unanimous and is achieved in a truly consensus-building way. That's not my issue. My issue is with legitimate scientific questions where very bright people disagree, you know, read the same set of information and come away with two different views of how to get to the same point. And I've seen it happen a number of times. And I want to have the flexibility to pick which way I think might get us there. And right now I'm not seeing that in this language. I'm seeing that whoever has the strongest personality and forces the issue is the advice we're going to be taking. And I don't think that's the right way to go. I think we need some flexibility here to get minority views, to get all the information that's out there, and that's what this council is for, is to make those hard choices. We don't agree all the time. You know, how we don't have unanimous votes on everything. I just don't believe the SSC is going to have them either. And all we're doing is shifting the burden one step down the food chain. We're saying, okay, you guys got to come up with a unanimous opinion, and then we're going to act on it. And I just, I don't think that's the right way to go.
Anyone else? Okay. So this is instead of doing it motion by motion, I think I have a sense from the council that this is not an acceptable change to the current operations handbook. If somebody wants to take a vote on these issues, issue by issue, happy to do that. Sally?
Yeah, this one's important. I think we need to be on the record where the council stands on this.
Okay.
So I would offer a motion to add the language that's in the revised document seven under correspondence and reports regarding plan development teams, item number one. All management alternatives shall incorporate and follow advice provided by the SSC.
Is there a second? Seconded by Pat Kirkle. We've had the debate. Pat?
I wonder if there's maybe some alternative language that might make people more comfortable and that Sally could also agree with. Instead of saying this, we say all management alternatives shall be consistent with the advice of the SSC. I think it leaves the room. It just says that we're going to follow scientific advice. It doesn't say that it has to be exactly what the SSC recommended. And it gives the flexibility to sort of go up and down.
Is that an agreeable change, Sally? Okay. There's the motion. There's been a change in language.
Advice
after SSC. We need to have further discussion on the language change. Jim Salisbury?
Well, while I think that's certainly in the right direction, my concern is that I agree with Sally's characterization that we need a much more robust SSC and get better scientific support for the plan development team. I've been on working with councils that have just that. They have very, very aggressive and very good SSCs, but oftentimes their advice is in ranges. It's this is acceptable or that is acceptable, and oftentimes it's directed by what question is asked them. So what this does is it supposes that we're asking the SSC the right question all the time, and that's what I think we're failing to anticipate. If you ask the SSC a very specific question, you may get a very specific answer and be stuck with doing that when there are alternatives to that. So, well, I think it's in the right direction, the right spirit, and I agree with that, and it answers a lot of the concerns. I think we're trying to force ourselves to do something that we really ought to have the integrity to do anyway. if we ask the right questions and we get good, thoughtful, scientific advice, then we should be considering that and acting on that. So I don't see why we are trying to force ourselves to do something sort of automatically. I think the present language in there is actually sufficient for me. I think we need what Sally is saying to get a more robust SSC, but it's sufficient to get their advice and then for us to consider it as thoroughly as we can and act on it. Thanks. So, you know, in short, I think it's a good step, but I just don't think it's necessary. I think we really need to follow it, just what's in the doctrine already. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Eight.
Opposed? Six. The motion carries 8-6. Paul?
Okay. On page 7, which is about the composition of the PDT, the executive committee concurs that members of council APs may not simultaneously serve on PDTs. So right now, I think we have one PDT, which is Groundfish, that has members of the APs, and the executive committee feels that there should be a distinction between AP members and PDTs, and that it's a dual function that shouldn't be dual, and that it should be just a technical committee, the PDT. So they're recommending the language under composition on page 7 be changed, that members of council APs may not serve on PDTs.
Jim Alden.
Yes, I'm opposed to this also. I feel that in the past, having an AP member on some of the PDTs has helped the PDT. The PDTs sometimes don't have the technical day-to-day knowledge of, fishing, for instance, or what happens on the water. And I think what I've seen in the past is that having the chairman of the AP be on the PDT has offered a lot of help to them in that regard, and I don't think it's been a hindrance at all. And if it has, I'd like to hear a rationale of why we're doing this. But on the face of it, I'm opposed to this.
Jim Salisbury, then Dave Pierce.
I have a question first, and that is, at present we have the chair of the AP on the multi-species PDT. And I don't know whether that's a requirement that it's just the chair or that it just happened to be the chair. Because what I would recommend, I think that some AP members are very technically helpful. They're technical people, and they have a technical experience that we can use on the PDTs. But I don't think it necessarily, that expertise resides in the chair. So I think it's just members of the council's any member of the council may be, if selected to be on there, I think is a good thing, but I don't think it should only be the chair for as an example. And I'm not sure what the present reason it is the chair, whether that's required or just happened to be the chair.
I think the only requirement, the only PDT that has a requirement is the Groundfish PDT right now. Amendment 13 changed the regs and actually dictates that the chair of the Groundfish AP and an industry member, not necessarily associated with the AP, has a slot on the PDT. Jim?
And to follow up on that, if we were to do this, this would require a change in the plan? We'd have to have a plan amendment in order to accomplish
this? Yes, sure. It would still require a change of Amendment 16 or some other Groundfish action.
Well, then I'd urge just not to make that change at this time, because not only do I think it's valuable sometimes to have them on there, but I think it doesn't warrant our going through and trying to change a plan over it. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Sally?
Yeah, the point of this is and I suggested no double dipping. Just like I don't think any council member should serve on an advisory panel. I don't think any council member should serve on a PDT. The influence and the participation in the debate that you get is in one of those arenas, at the council, through an advisory panel, through the PDT, and they're very different bodies. And the council should be able to consider the advice and the knowledge that comes from those very different bodies separately. So I don't think there should be double dipping, and I think it should be clear what kind of advice is coming from the different bodies.
Dr. Pierce?
I've got a preference as to how a plan development team should function relative to getting valuable input from industry members, but I know it won't be accepted because we tried this already and it didn't work, that we actually had, in some cases, a bit of anarchy where the industry was too aggressive at plan development team meetings and interfered with plan development team progress, and that led to the current strategy that we employ where you must be mute. You can't be present. You've got to be quiet. Or if you want to listen to what's happening, you have to go to the council office and listen on a phone. It prevents any kind of exchange between plan development team members and the industry. So I understand why it's done, but still my preference is to have industry present in the room with some real strict ground rules acknowledged so that if indeed something really needs to be the question needs to be asked, then that the members in the room could offer up some answers to the plan development teams. I share Sally's view on this. I don't believe that members of advisory panels should also be on plan development teams. Plan development teams have tremendous responsibility now, and that responsibility is bound to increase in the future, and it just doesn't seem appropriate to have this, as Sally said, kind of double dipping. So I would support the suggestion described in the document that members of council APs may not simultaneously serve on PDTs.
Paul Howard.
One of the other things for the council to consider is that I imagine over the next 5 years that the work we're doing is going to be primarily allocation. And if you're going to be involved in developing alternatives for allocation, qualification periods, histories, all that kind of stuff, you know, you put industry members in a very difficult position to be unbiased and dealing with very technical stuff, and it's difficult. So think about the kind of alternatives we're going to be developing for all allocation in the future.
Gentleman from the Granite State.
Sally, would you on the executive committee also feel that this should apply to all industry members? This just says AP members may not simultaneously serve, and you were making the point about not double dipping, but if it was the advice of this council to have another industry member outside the advisory panel on the PDT, would that also be prohibited?
If you look at page 7, composition, if you look at all those categories that we would compose the PDT, there's not a category for industry. It says economist status over on the right, second paragraph on the right, PDT members shall be economists, statisticians, anthropologists, sociologists, etc. But there's no mention of industry members. So I think that although it isn't specifically said there'll be no industry members, it's not listed here. The only place that said in one industry member was the Groundfish Committee. Okay, that if we adopt this policy, this is the makeup, and there'll be no AP members on it, then theoretically the Groundfish plan would be out of compliance with our policy. So I guess the roundabout answer is there'd be no industry members on the PDT if you approve this.
Jim Salisbury.
Well, a couple of items. One is to respond to Paul. When he says that the Groundfish plan would be out of compliance with the policy, it would seem to me that, you know, a policy doesn't trump the plan. The plan trumps the policy in a sense of plan. It has regulations and it has so our policy notwithstanding, we'd still have an AP member on the Groundfish PDT. That's my understanding of it. Secondly, I want to respond to, I take note of Sally's comments about double dipping, and I wonder why then on the next page the under the advisory panels is this proposal, I presume accepted by the executive committee, that says that you will have a council member as the chairman of the AP. So
we said no.
Oh, you said no. Okay. Well, then I agree with that part.
Anyone else in the council? Dave Gatham.
Yeah, I'm going to support this reluctantly. I see both sides. I think there's value to having industry there, but I don't think there's value to having only one member of industry there. No one person can represent, as an example, all the fisheries and groundfish. It can't be done. None of us have that expertise. And that puts somebody in a more favorable light in a very important position, one gear type potentially than any other, whatever gear that person happens to fish with. But I think we should recognize as a result of this right up front that we're going to have more work to do at both the committee level and the council level as we get things from the PDT that don't take into account the fishing aspect of fishing. We wanted to reduce the yellowtail catch. Well, we'll have everybody fish with a raised foot rope trawl for groundfish. Yeah, we would have reduced the yellowtail catch and all the other flounders, and the cod, and everything else. I mean, that's the type of thing that comes out when you don't have somebody there who recognizes the practical constraints of gear types. So as long as people are willing to live with that shortcoming and recognize they're going to have to recraft some things that come from the PDT because the PDT does not have fishing experience, then, if that's the trade we're going to make and that's what we're willing to do, that's fine.
Just real quickly, Mr. Chairman, we had a lengthy discussion yesterday. Maybe the answer to this problem is we have to use our advisors better than we use them. And so if you look at the model, we don't even follow our own model that says the PDT does its work and then it's vetted through the advisors and then it goes to the committee. We need, just like we have the SSC in our process now, that's going to be, at every council meeting and we get to know them and everything, we've got to use our advisors more systematically so we know who they are and that they provide a valuable product on time and et cetera. So I think as we move on, that may be an answer to having the industry off of the PDT is use them as our advisor.
I had Sally, then Dana Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given that there seems to be lack of consensus around this, I would move that in the plan development team section of the operations handbook, at the end of the composition section, to add the text, members of council APs may not simultaneously serve on PDTs.
A second. Seconded by Dave Preble. Dana, you had your hand up. Basically, Sally made a motion. Instead of seeking consensus, she turned it into a motion. It's the same issue that we've been debating. It took me a second to figure out what the heck just happened to Dana.
I'm not exactly sure I figured it out yet, Mr. Chairman, but thank you. And I'd be brief. There's a lot of good comments on both sides, but the potential for some of this stuff it bothers me a lot. And what we're doing here is, I think we can do better in a lot of cases, but what we're doing here bothers me tremendously because we're just sort of clinically eliminating fishermen or people that are affected most by what happens in this process, eliminating them out of the process. And even, I appreciate the comments, but I'm very uncomfortable with doing that at this time, and I would not support this approach. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anyone else that hasn't spoken on this issue? Okay. Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Ten in favor. Opposed? Five opposed. Six opposed. Abstentions? None. Motion carries 10 to 6. Paul.
Okay. On page 11, under FMP development process. There was a couple comments that the process should include SSC early on in the process. And so we did make those changes. So if you look at the FMP development process on page 11, we have the SSC in two sections, right up front to meet the requirements of Magnuson Act by providing recommendations for acceptable biological catch, preventing overfishing, the things I read to you before, and those are included on page 8 under SSC duties. So that would come up front. And then also at the very end, where, again, SSCs are required to provide us with advice on other things as well, at the very end, we'd add the SSC, too, to give advice to the council on the final product. So this would be our FMP development process and the executive committee. One other change they recommended that we'll do. You see where it says... it goes council, committee advisors, SSC, council, and then PDT advisors. The PDT and advisors would be, in the diagram, would be offshoots of the committee, and not necessarily the council go directly to the PDT and advisors. That just like the SSC is off of the council, we put the advisors and PDT off of the committee. So we'll change this flow chart a little bit, but the substantive change is putting the SSC early in the process and also late in the process, and that's what the executive committee recommends.
Comments on the flow chart? Questions? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, again, just to help me out a little bit, executive committee, I certainly understand why the SSC is up front, but why is the SSC involved at the very end? Providing final advice on the management program. Would you elaborate a little bit regarding the nature of that advice? Clearly, the advice relates to, early on in the process, to the Magnuson Act requirements that we get from the SSC, those annual catch limits for each of the managed species, and they may not exceed the fishing level recommendations, et cetera, et cetera. So what else? You know, what else is going to be coming from the SSC? Again, just to bring me up to speed again, because I can't recall the additional role the SSC is going to have.
In up front, if I would, Mr. Chairman, up front, initially, they'll give us the acceptable biological catch, you know, kind of like, you know, based on the status of the stock and the, you know, recruitment and everything, they'll say this is the ABC. We develop a plan and set annual catch limits and measures to achieve that lower than, not exceeding that level. So what they set the level at SSC initially, and then they review our plan to make sure we're going to achieve the rebuilding and everything else, that what we're doing in our plan is actually going to work.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, that the last reference, last statement that Paul made.
Giving us advice.
Yeah, I had assumed that the plan development team would do that and not the SSC. You know, the plan development team has a lot to do, of course, but now the plan development team takes it to the final step almost, and then it gets thrown back to the SSC for it to have further critique. I didn't realize that we'd have to drag the SSC back in. I thought we would just, you know, go with the plan development team. And this particular critique of what we have offered up as management alternatives, will we achieve the objectives? Will all of the advice of the SSC be followed relative to the acceptable catch levels? And that's what the PDT would then advise us on, as opposed to jumping back to the SSC. It seems the SSC would have to do a lot more work, would have to evaluate the plan development team work to see if indeed the plan development team did a good job. And is that where we want to go? I thought that the plan development team would have a lot more status, more oomph, and not, in a sense, be subservient to the SSC. Again, just seeking clarification as to what the best way for us to proceed is.
Dave, if you look at what the SSCs must do, that's what the law, they have to give us advice on are our plans and measures achieving rebuilding. So in other words, the SSC gives us a number. The PDT does all the work to make sure we don't exceed that number. And then they review that to make sure. They give us advice on whether the PDT work is going to achieve rebuilding and minimize bycatch and everything else that the Act says they're supposed to do. I don't see...
Anyone else in the council? Okay. Ready for the question? No, actually, we don't have a motion. Do we have an objection to the flow chart in the document? No objection. Flow chart's approved without objection. Paul.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Advisory panels, we jump to, and if you look at advisory panels 1A and 1B are pretty specific about setting agendas by executive committee and having different makeup of advisory panels. And the executive committee did not agree with 1A and 1B, but rather would like to come back at the next council meeting and perhaps give another straw man about advisory panels. In other words, the executive committee talked about having one advisory panel, similar to the Alaska Council. And that one advisory panel would meet, again, similar to our SSC, either in conjunction with the council meetings or right before them, and be given a long laundry list of things to actually review in all different plans. And the executive committee felt as we get more and more into ecosystem management and trade-offs between different plans and species, it would be better to have this multifaceted advisory panel, which would include habitat and everything else. You know, perhaps three members from each species committee and habitat, quite large. But we felt that if we reconstituted that, it might add more importance to the committee. We'd use them more effectively. And we weren't ready to recommend that now because I want to do a lot more work on who's going to task them, because it's going to be very important for the, you know, tasking them and when they meet and things like that. So if the council agrees, then I'll prepare a straw man for February to look at having one advisory panel. And that's what the Act says, too. The Act says one advisory panel, but we do several, which is okay, too. And that, you know, we would look at that for February.
Jim Salisbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Paul's comments, and I think that while I have some enthusiasm for the idea of a single AP-type approach, we should be careful that in using the North Pacific as an example, there the AP and the SSC are relatively co-equal groups. They both meet, again, just during, actually, the council meeting. They both have a very important role. But they both provide final advice to the council, sometimes a little divergent, but again, it's still advice. The other thing I would caution is that we may want to revisit the flow chart after we change the role of the AP, if we were to change the role of the AP, because, you know, I think we're looking at that now within our minds the way we operate now. And if you change that, the advisors may want to be, it may be shuffled around that the SSC and advisors come in at a different point in the chart. That's all I can make of the comment. Thank you.
Dave Gaithel, was that, you had your hand up?
Yeah. Paul, would this allow you to create ad hoc advisory panels as needed? I was thinking of like the general category scallop amendment where we needed a specific set of advice, but nothing will preclude that from still occurring.
Right. John, in fact, John mentioned that, you know, we could still have ad hoc people groups like we did general category and things like that as well.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I've been, as I've mentioned before, I've been appalled at the some of the AP antics And I think that this direction is the best way to go. And I just wanted to say that the reauthorized act, to address what Dave Gaethel says, states specifically, each council shall establish and maintain a fishing industry advisory committee, which shall provide information and recommendations on and assist in the development of fishery management plans and amendments to such plans. That's not discretionary. The act says it shall be done. And immediately before that, the section immediately before that, it does address other advisory panels, and it uses the words as are necessary or appropriate. So the MSA essentially supports what they want to do here. It not only does not preclude ad hoc advisory panels, it tends to support that notion that the proper way to do it is with one large fishing industry advisory committee, and then as necessary, ad hoc APs. Thank you.
There's no action to be taken. We'll have another look at this, and I think Jim's point on if we do change the way we structure APs and how we use APs or an AP, then taking a look at the flow chart about how we develop plans and do business should be part of that. Okay. Paul.
Okay, then, Mr. Chairman, then at the February Council meeting, we'll bring a couple straw men for different ways to do advisory panels to vote on one practice. Concerning number two and number three,
unless there's objection, we're going to not deal with two and three until we deal with the AP when we come back in February. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Public testimony is on page 19. And if you read the shaded in area is what the council staff developed in response to what the executive committee had tasked us to do. The executive committee wanted, as the public comes to the microphone, to give testimony. They wanted more information about who the individuals represent and, things like that. So this would be a policy on information for the public when submitted oral and written statements. And if you review that, and if you have any, and the executive committee approved that shaded language.
Everyone had a chance to look at that language? Any problems or suggestions for additions or deletions? Any objections to the language? Seeing none, it's adopted without objection.
Next is sector policy, which is section 15, page 24. And under sectors, there's a paragraph there on page 24, third from the last, that says each FMP should state that vessels can only be in one sector within that FMP in any fishing year. And then there's a second sentence that says, furthermore, a vessel cannot be in more than one sector in different FMPs in the same year. Now, that's the policy that was developed by our sector committee, with ample public input and agenda. These recommendations to delete that sentence were not approved by the executive committee. They may have agreed with what they do by deleting that sentence. It does allow people to be in more than one sector, and some of the executive committee agreed with it. But they didn't agree with the process of doing it right here, that the sector committee just developed that policy that was approved by the council with a lot of notice and agenda. So what we'd like to do is add that, the removal of that sentence at the next February council meeting, to give the public and you folks an opportunity to discuss what does that mean if we change this policy that we just had the sector committee do. And give the public an opportunity to make comments on it with looking at it for a couple months. So what the executive committee is recommending that we address this as a specific agenda item, the removal of that sentence on the February agenda, to give the public more and the councils more opportunity to develop comments.
I have a question. Paul, you said that the sector committee, I don't remember your exact words, developed this policy. Did the council adopt that by vote, the policy? Not.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think people should be aware this could be potentially a major change. We adopted it. At least I knew what I was voted on. I knew exactly what I was voted on. And I'm concerned, quite frankly, that allowing this to happen will give you instances where somebody can join two sectors in two different fishery management plans and then, let the sector fish the share in one plan and go fish in the other plan. And it effectively has the potential to increase effort quite a bit. I mean, right now, you can't do that. You got to fish your own share. And so I just want people to be aware where this is headed. This is a major change that may have major mortality implications if we adopt it. So, granted, we could come back in February and have another bite at the apple, but I'm not real comfortable with where this is headed at the moment.
No one else? Okay, so we're going to postpone this issue until February. It'll be brought back up on February. It'll be on our agenda. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Enforcement, section 16, page 25. And there's a whole couple paragraphs that basically on the right-hand section, top on 25, that says effort control, i.e. days at sea quotas versus restricted quantities, trip limits. And the executive committee really didn't like the language and the language in that specific section and didn't think it was really necessary, so they agreed to eliminate that whole section. So if you'd read it and see if you agree.
Pat.
I hate to be fatiguing, but that said, the Enforcement Committee report is going to follow this agenda item, and they are going to recommend adoption to have a new enforcement policy replace this one, and it is behind it on page 27. It is largely, just so we don't have chaos here, it's largely the same language, cleaned up a little bit, added to by the Coast Guard, and there's a little bit more advice in there. It's another one, if you haven't had time to take a look, you may want to defer until the February meeting. But the Enforcement Committee, I believe, unless I'm hideously mistaken, okay, great, I'm not hideously mistaken, that the Enforcement Committee is going to bring that recommendation forward. So you may want to put that in the category of take a look at in a couple of months. Up to you.
February is getting booked. Jim.
I just need to clarify in my mind what we just said. Rather than right now taking out this language, two paragraphs under effort controls, the whole enforcement policy package is going to be replaced. So is that correct? Or are you saying let's take this out now and then see what they do later?
Confession. I personally wasn't aware that we were going to look at adopting an enforcement, a new enforcement policy. I'm not sure what other council members can confess to that as well, but I see some heads nodding up and down. We weren't thinking about a new policy when we talked about removing this language. So, Jim.
without making a motion to the effect, but could I recommend that we just wait and look at the overall policy? Because I think that in that there are a lot of changes. The whole tone is different.
Yeah.
And perhaps more useful to us. So just look at the whole thing first.
I agree with you. Yeah. Paul.
Pat, help me out with this. Could we not do this? Basically, see where it says general. Why can't we say, during development of a fishery management plan, the council and its oversight committees are encouraged to be cognizant of the guidelines in Enclosure 1 and call Enclosure 1. So in other words, we're getting rid of this whole document and saying that the council shall be guided by the NOAA Coast Guard guidelines. Isn't that the easiest way to do it? And that all that says is we're using that as a guide, and that's our policy to use what they've presented. And if we agree under the next agenda item, enforcement, then it's easy for us to say, okay, we'll just use as our guide what the enforcement committee developed for us. No? Is that not clear?
You could. I mean, I understood what you said. You could very well do that. And if people feel like they've had an adequate review of the replacement,
right.
Because as I said, it was largely rewritten from this policy. You
right.
know, it's sort of been traded back and forth between the council, NIMS, and now the Coast Guard. But it is largely a rewrite, but there are some additional pieces of advice in the latest version. But, yes, that would, short answer,
but,
would do
but
the
if,
trick.
If you haven't read the whole thing, then what I would do then in February is just have Section 16 Enforcement Policy, one paragraph with the attached Coast Guard and NOAA document, and say the council as a policy will be guided by the Coast Guard NOAA document. That's what I'll do in February.
Is there objection to that? Okay. Paul? Without objection.
And last, Mr. Chairman, aquaculture, it's in the back of the book. It's no longer relevant with the new aquaculture bill pending, and we've reviewed the aquaculture bill, and most of the new aquaculture bill and federal EEZ aquaculture is about pollution and impacts on habitat and things like that. So the executive committee recommends that the Habitat Committee update our aquaculture policy when appropriate, when the bill is passed, and et cetera.
Any objection? Seeing none. Okay, that's it, Paul, right?
Just one final thing. There are several policies in the back that were eliminated because we felt they were no longer relevant. Aquaculture, fail-safe voting, multi-species management policy, and open and closed areas. Those would be totally deleted because they're no longer relevant. The executive committee agreed with that.
Dave.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to bring to the council's attention, and I don't know if it's purposeful or not, on page 40 on the Research Steering Committee, for the members that are not members of the council, it says at the upper right-hand side, non-council members will serve without compensation but will be paid for travel, meals, etc. In the advisors, it's been updated to say that they will be compensated if funds are available. So I don't know if, I mean, I would like to see a change for the Research Steering Committee as well to say have the language be consistent, that they'd be compensated if funds are available. They work pretty hard.
Is it to this point, Jim? Okay. Is there any objection to creating consistency? Does anyone not want to be consistent? You're still awake, though, aren't you? Okay. Without objection, Paul will make that change in the language. Jim Salisbury?
A clarification for me on the fail-safe voting issue. I know years ago that was followed fairly rigorously, and it's my impression that it basically wasn't, the policy wasn't changed, we just sort of don't do it anymore. Is that the correct characterization? Then I think maybe we ought to take a look at it and think about it, because it in the past it's been pretty effective at doing some of the exact things that we've had trouble with here lately, where we do something and then after we kind of see all the ramifications of it, we may wish we hadn't, or may wish we had revised it a little bit. And that seemed to, in the past, that seemed to help with that situation. So, well, I don't want to necessarily just sort of say we have to go back to the old days. I think it does help us at some point, may help us. If we followed it, it may not be so difficult to deal with. It was pretty routine at the time.
We, if we do follow it, we feel, the staff that decided to take those out, that we would be redebating the next day everything that we, that's what tended to happen, is you redebate, you know, you continually debate. And we don't have the luxury with the way our council meetings are and our deadlines and everything like that to have this fail-safe, that we have an agenda, and if it's a long agenda, our decision documents today give a certain amount of time and everything to make the final decisions that we're I think our meetings are much better focused today on making decisions and decision making for the council, and if we do this, I think it's totally against the way we do our business now, and it'll be very difficult to, you know, have the public stay around for an extra day.
Pat, can you pull the mic closer to you? I was having trouble hearing you last time you were speaking.
No.
Thank you.
Here you go. When we had fail-safe voting, we didn't have quite the same strict guidelines about the agenda preparation and publication. That came later. And the public has come to expect the vote to be taken place when they are present. And what happens when you use the fail-safe mechanism is, as Paul said, they've gone home, and the vote is taken the next day. And most people, certainly not the volume of people that we have when a vote is on the agenda for that hour and for that time, most people are not present. Noah gave us some guidelines about maybe 10 years ago. My God, I'm dating myself hideously. About agenda preparation and publication, and we do have a caveat that says that, you know, we can juggle things around a little bit, but the audience has reacted over the years when we've changed things around and moved votes from one day to another, so we really try to stick to it, and I only speak as the person who prepares the agenda to just sort of offer you that perspective.
Anyone else on the council? Okay. Dave?
Well, I was just going to say, I think it would be great to get this out of here. I mean, I think it was terrible from an audience perspective. I mean, you had to hang around the whole 3 days because you were never sure when somebody was going to bring something back up again and re-debate it. I think it cost the council a lot of credibility. Anyway, I just think it should be removed, and we should take things on the agenda and finish them. And that's it for that day, so that people got some sense of what's going on and that they feel they come on the right day to comment on the right thing.
Okay, anything else on the operations handbook? We passed, that's right, Dave. We did pass a bunch of issues off till February, but we'll revisit those. Dave?
Yeah, the one other thing, given the extended discussion on the SSC and its new extremely important role, on page 8, under organization, the second paragraph says the executive director will prepare a list of nominees, and the 5 voting members of the executive committee will appoint the SSC. I would suggest that be changed to the council appoint members to the SSC so that it's a more inclusive process. I think there's a lot at stake here, and I think the full council ought to carry that responsibility.
Is
So you're suggesting to change the language under organization, paragraph 2?
Yeah, to substitute 5 voting members of the executive committee, replace that with council. So it will read, the council will appoint SSC members.
Is there a second? Seconded by Jim Salisbury. Discussion on the motion. Sally.
Yeah, we didn't talk about this in that aspect of the SSC in great detail yesterday, but in looking that section over again, my thought was actually that we should put that in the hands of the executive director. I know that's a lot to give to Paul to do, but my concern is that if the council is voting on who's going to be on the SSC, then it's going to politicize the science that our decisions are based on. And shouldn't we have a more dispassionate look at who is serving on the SSC than having either the executive committee or the whole council do it? And I realize it is a very important decision that is made who's going to be on the SSC, but you know, that's why he's the executive director, and you know, has a very different view on these kinds of appointments than the council as a whole. So that was my thought. I'll just put that out there for now and oppose the motion.
To the motion, council. Dave Gatham.
I actually support the motion. I think it's a good idea. I mean, we've got to face the fact that science is going to be politicized now from here on in anyway. All we're doing is moving the point of first insertion down the flow chart. Now everybody's going to attack the members of the SSC and try and get the best deal they can out of them. That's just a fact of life. And people who are going to serve on the SSC better have a thick hide, because they're going to be getting a lot of phone calls. I think the executive director should prepare a list of candidates, and the council should vote on the executive director's list. That provides transparency. It allows for some debate. It allows for some balance to make sure that we do have all the political spectrums represented as best we can, because as we all know in science, there certainly are. I mean, it's not a vacuum. People have views outside, you know, the just the facts, Joe Friday, I'm a scientist role. And we all recognize that. So I'm always for more transparency in government. The more we can make this process open and inclusive, I think the better off we are. So anyway, I think it's a good idea.
Okay, Dana Rice, then Pat, then Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, I think about everything we do or this body does or anybody associated with it is going to be deemed to be political, but it's a pretty democratic process if you had a list of people or so, some people that were going to be nominated and it was vetted by all of the members around the board. I think it would be as democratic as you could probably get it. Thank you.
Pat.
I'm opposed to the motion. I think it adds an unnecessary complication, and really only for the purpose of making it more political than it's going to be anyway. And I just don't think that makes sense, so I'm going to oppose the motion.
Frank.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to oppose the motion because as far as being an open process, it's still going to have to be done behind closed doors because you can't discuss personnel and matters like that at a public meeting, so it would have to be a closed-door meeting anyway. Having sat through years and years of picking advisors, I hate to say it, but I don't think most people read the advisors we have. And they go through and you go down a list and they say, do you like this person? Do you not like that person? And I think we're going to be tying up a tremendous amount of council time going through a list. And I like the executive director making up the list and being reviewed. I think that's the way to go. I think for expediency, and I think for just the opposite, I think it will be a very political thing if we go the other way.
Jim Odlin, then Doug.
Just looking at the MSA, it says each council shall establish, maintain, and appoint members of the Scientific and Statistical Committee. That's 1A. And then you go down further to C. It says members appointed by the council to the scientific committee. I think I would submit that the intent was for the councils to appoint people to the SSC. I support the motion.
Doug.
I'm going to oppose the motion. I agree. I think having a small committee of this council appointing this with the advice of the executive director is the best way to do. Smaller committees work better.
Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Eight.
Opposed. Eight to seven. Chair votes against. It's a tie. Motion fails. Anything else? Dave.
Just wanted to clarify that it was 8-7 and not 8-6. I counted six hands against. If we could recheck that.
Sure. Again, revote. We're going to vote again. There was some confusion. All those in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. Keep it up. Eight. Opposed. Seven. Chair votes. Eight. Motion's tied. Fails. Anything else? All set, Paul? Okay, Rodney? Please.